It says, please wait while your presentation is loading. I don't know whether that means on the projector or up here, but we seem to be there now. Thank you. Just to start by saying thank you very much for that kind introduction. There's been a slight change in the programme because, in actual fact, what I've got to say follows on beautifully from what Agis has just talked to you about. So this was seamless, even though I have to say we didn't discuss it beforehand. So, healthy communities promote healthy minds and bodies. What's the contribution of civil society? Well, what am I going to be talking about this morning? A little bit about inequalities in health, some of the health challenges that we're all going to be facing as we move through the next few decades, because you probably don't need me to tell you, but the combination of those health challenges will be really very, very significant. A little bit about the role of the third or the voluntary sector, some local practical examples. So I'd like to give you a few examples from my own experience of local community-led initiatives. And then, if time allows, I'd like to finish with a poem. Now, I'm going to do all of this with a little bit of help. And before I show you the next slide, because I do want a slightly light-hearted approach to this, I have checked out with some of my American friends that the slides I'm going to be using are acceptable to Americans, particularly as I believe that most of you will be Democrats rather than Republicans. So I'm going to do this with some illustrative comments and observations from that wonderful raconteur that you had as a former American president. This is actually, believe it or not, a live take from TV. It was purely coincidental that at the bottom here, this was the news feed that just happened to be running along the bottom of the TV just as the picture of George Bush came onto the TV. So this was actually a quotation that he said, one of the worst disasters to hit the US. I can't remember what it was he was talking about, but it was a great pity that it happened to be just running across the bottom of the TV just as his picture was there. So I will be doing this with a little bit of help from your former president. Let's just look very briefly at this social gradient to which Agis Zouros referred. In London, the difference in life expectancy from the most affluent parts of London to the least affluent ranges from 88 years to 71 years. 17 years worth of difference of life expectancy. Poor people die sooner and live with many more years of disability. Now, what's really interesting here is, depending upon which study you take, is really the contribution of the healthcare system to the overall level of health in the population. The most optimistic people reckon that the healthcare services contribute no more than a third towards the overall level of health in a population. If you look at some of the Scandinavian countries, they put the figure closer to 10 to 15%. So health is determined outside of the healthcare system to a very considerable extent. That's not to suggest that healthcare isn't important. It clearly is, but it's not the major determinant of health. If you look at these differences, and even if you take out the top 5%, the people who are in the most affluent groups with the best level of health, and you take out the bottom 5%, the people who are most disadvantaged, there is still in that remaining 90%, 13 years of difference in disability-free life. There's a 70% gap in infant mortality in England between those who are advantaged and those who are disadvantaged. And the calculation is that health inequalities in England account for around 2.5 million lost years of life every single year. The cost is absolutely phenomenal. Now, this is a map of the London Underground system, our metro system. You have Westminster in affluent central London here, working its way across to the east of London, where we have the least affluent people. Every two stations on this east running line represents 1 year of life lost in terms of average life expectancy. You could not have a better illustration than this of the difference in health expectations between the most affluent and the least affluent. Now, Agus has referred to the Michael Marmot review. Of course, there was the global review. He was then asked to undertake by the chief medical officer in England a review for England. And, of course, he's been undertaking a review for Europe as well. I'm only going to summarise this very quickly. I'm just picking out a few points from the Marmot review. The lower a person's social position, the worse his or her health is. Action on health inequalities requires action across all the social determinants. Health inequalities result in lost productivity, reduced tax revenue, increased welfare benefits, and higher treatment costs. Health is an economic good. It's not just a social good. It's about economic productivity, and it's a major factor, just as financial investment is. Health investment is for the good of the economic prosperity of the country as well. An action is required by central and local government, the National Health Service, the third and the private sectors, and community groups. And as Michael Marmot made the point, local delivery requires effective participatory local decision making. So health is created as we are the converted. I think we all know this, and we do actually increasingly talk to groups outside. You're absolutely right, Agus, but we have to convince all of these people in other sectors as well. Health is created or destroyed where people live out their daily lives, where they live, love, work and play, where they grow, where they develop and where they socialise. They're not just a function of their genes, but also their social and physical environments, their patterns of consumption and the socialisation influences to which they are exposed. And this is a phrase I have coined. Community and environment provide the social DNA that determines our development and our health-related behaviour. We are a function of both our genetics and also what I have described as our social DNA. And we all know that the other social determinants of health are housing, education, the way we plan our towns and cities, trade and economic policy, yes, the healthcare system, but it's also about how our agriculture operates right the way through from primary agricultural production to the food we consume on our table. It's about employment and it's about social welfare benefits. So what about the challenges that we're going to face? What are the shape of things to come? Yes, certainly we have got all of these lifestyle issues that we're going to be facing in the coming decades. It is a real irony for someone like me, who started life as a population biologist, that the human species was the best adapted species to its environment on the planet. We were so well adapted, and with these huge brains that we had, we were able to actually change that very environment for which we were so well adapted. And social and technological evolution moves at a pace, but biological evolution, until we map the human genome, of course, has moved at a very slow pace. And we no longer have an environment. We have created an environment for ourselves for which we are no longer biologically adapted. And that is why we have so many of the health problems that we're facing today. So we have those lifestyle issues to face. We also have the future challenges of new and re-emerging communicable diseases, more rapid transmission because of global communication and transport, with increasing demands upon our healthcare system. And we had, or some of us, had a lucky escape from H5N1. I am sure this emerged from Photoshop. It cannot be a genuine slide. However, it serves to illustrate the point that we were very lucky with H5N1. Had H5N1, avian flu, bird flu, had that turned into a variant that was capable of human-to-human transmission, we were looking at a situation where, for example, the contingency planning in the United States worst-case scenario was that if it became pandemic flu on an H5N1 strain, it could have been potentially 18 million deaths in the United States. You just need to think of the 1918 pandemic flu outbreak to realize the potential scale of the problem. We had a lucky break. On top of which, we have all of these new health technologies coming down the road. And these will be available much more readily to the most affluent in society as compared to those who are the most disadvantaged. Better vaccination and immunization, more effective screening, better medical interventions. It will always be the better off who are able to access these so much better. So our future health challenges as we move through this century are the modern non-communicable diseases, the so-called lifestyle issues of today, re-emerging communicable diseases, emergency and disaster responses, often related to climate change, and emerging communicable diseases as well. On top of which we have major demographic shifts taking place, an increase in older citizens, a smaller proportion of people who are economically active, and an increase in migration within countries and between continents and ethnic groups, not least driven by some of the consequences of climate change. And yesterday, of course, was really quite an auspicious day. Yesterday was the day when the planet reached a population of 7 billion people. And nearly all of our health-related problems are to some extent related to a combination of overpopulation and overconsumption. So health for the future is going to be a real balancing act between economic growth and sustainable development, between healthcare and action on the fundamental determinants of health, between energy demand and environmental impact, and of course this key issue of improvements for the affluent at the expense of the worst off. And just to give you a bit of an illustration, this is actually taken from a document looking at the sustainable development of health systems. Not specifically about public health. And it makes the point that we need to move from institution-led healthcare to community and health and social care, curative medical care to early intervention, from sickness to health and well-being strategies, from a professional-led service to a personally orientated service, from isolated and segregated care to integrated care in partnership in the community, from buildings focused on buildings to healing environments, from decisions driven by current financial considerations to taking into account the future value in terms of the impact upon society and nature, and a variety of issues of this kind. You'll be able to look at the slide later because I believe that they'll all be accessible. But these people who put these points together were not interested specifically in public health, where they were looking at a sustainable healthcare system. And I'd just like to draw everyone's attention, I'm sure you're aware of this, we talk about the so-called non-communicable diseases, but as far as I'm concerned, these non-communicable diseases are in fact communicable diseases. And the vectors for communicating them through our populations are culture and media, the education that we have, the socialization processes that we're subject to, our physical environment, the goods and services we consume, and our economic circumstances. These are the vectors for communicating the so-called non-communicable diseases. And we need to start early because it is absolutely clear from the evidence that children are products of the environment in which they grow and develop. And if we get this right, and we invest carefully and properly in the younger years, we can actually avoid some of the disasters that might occur later on in life. I am glad I always worry when I use slides like this with an American audience that I might be offending someone. We do make fun of our own politicians in the UK as well. Unless you think that health doesn't have major benefits, UNICEF carried out a major econometric exercise during the 1990s, and they looked at the reasons for global economic growth between 1790 and 1980, a period of almost 200 years. And over 50% of global economic growth during that period of time was a result of two factors, and they were both public health developments: better nutrition and better sanitation. Lest anyone doubt that health is an economic good, the UNICEF exercise, which was a very sophisticated one, it's worth bearing in mind. And what is more, in terms of the disadvantaged people in our societies, it's not rocket science. We know what we need to do. If we could only give the 20% most disadvantaged in our societies the same living conditions and opportunities and circumstances as the 20% most advantaged, we would absolutely transform health and the demand upon our healthcare system. So we need to do something differently. If you always do what you've always done, you will always get what you've always had. We need to think differently. And governments, at least intellectually, are by and large committed to this more devolved, delegated approach. The difficulty comes, as Agis was saying, when you start to translate this into practice, when you start to implement this. I just take this as one, merely one example from, in actual fact, the previous government in the UK, although I think the current government would sign up to exactly the same sort of philosophy. It's about delegating power to local communities. And why? Because community engagement, those local communities, are actually pretty good at determining local needs and defining what their expectations are. They can help us identify the whole range of community assets, including the communication structures that are there. No community is a blank sheet of paper. Every community has assets that can be used for the benefits of health. Local people should, can and are able to design and deliver services. They can help ensure that there is community action in the interests of better health. And Agis used the phrase governance. It actually helps to ensure our accountability back to those local populations. And when sometimes public health is accused of measures that come close to social engineering, it is absolutely crucial that we have the public on our side, that we are accountable to the public, and what we do in the public's name is acceptable to the public. So local communities can help us to identify priorities, to determine where the community assets are and how to engage and communicate with those priorities. They help ensure that we are actually more sensitive to local community circumstances and situations. And I just ask you to look at the floods behind to see that I'm sure, again, this must have been done. This must have been doctored at some stage, but it helps to make the point rather well. Local communities' engagement can help us to be more accountable for what we do. They can provide extra capacity because we will never have enough professional staff to do all that needs to be done. And the voluntary sector, the third sector, has a whole variety of contributions to make. From advocacy and patient representation through to providing information and access to communities, some voluntary sector bodies provide financial support and are fundraisers, others directly provide services, some provide client and patient support, some will undertake research and generate research funding. They represent civic society because it's often rather difficult to find the precise conduit for doing that, and they provide that same conduit through to government and to the bureaucracies. The third sector, civil society, provides a whole range of functions. And what are the strengths? Well, as we've already heard, they're close to the local population, they can represent the patient or community experience, they will often take risks in a way that public sector bureaucracies will not. I have worked for a private sector organisation, I've been a dean in a university, I've been a chief executive in the public sector, and I'm now a chief executive in the voluntary sector. I can tell you that of all those sectors, the third sector is the most cost-effective of them all. It produces greater outputs for the same input than any of the other sectors I've worked for. The third sector tends to be non-bureaucratic, and it's pretty good at both determining what the assets are in a community, and it's a trusted source of information as well. Now, I want to give you just a couple of quick examples. My very first job in public health, as a young man in my mid-20s, I worked at a place called Dudley in the West Midlands. When I arrived there, I was called into the then equivalent of the local medical officer of health. And he was a gentleman who'd recently come out of the army. And when I arrived in his office, he said, "Okay, Parrish, sit down there." So I sat down and I listened to him for 10 minutes. And he said to me that Dudley in the West Midlands had the worst perinatal mortality rate in the whole of Europe. This is a population of just under 300,000 people. And then he went on to say, "I want you to get out there and I want you to teach all of these women to look after themselves better during their pregnancy so we actually improve this perinatal mortality rate." And as a rather perhaps timid young man at the time, certainly one with a lot to learn, I left his office and I thought to myself, how do we know that that is the reason? We had two major municipal housing estates, the poor parts of Dudley. I went into those communities. I used some of the local community leaders to talk to many of these women. And hey, guess what? Most of them knew pretty well what they ought to be doing. The problem was being able to take control over their lives and do the things that they knew they ought to do. One of the things I identified then was that we had the lowest termination rate, abortion rate, in the whole of the United Kingdom. And I asked myself, well, why could that be? And it turned out that we had only one consultant obstetrician and gynecologist for this population. The norm at that time, we should have had three. For religious reasons, no matter what the screening might show, he refused to do a termination. We also discovered that many of the local family doctors were confirming a pregnancy at 6 or 7 weeks and saying, come back when it is 8 months, by which time, of course, it is rather too late. And the third thing we discovered, long before the social determinants of health became one of the key issues to consider, was that the antenatal services were 3 bus journeys away. You had to change buses 3 bus journeys away from where these two municipal housing estates were. And if you're a mum with 2 or maybe 3 children under the age of 5, you are not going to make that journey. And what we did was to persuade the local regional health authority to appoint another consultant. We ran a training program for the local GPs, and we persuaded what was called the passenger transport executive to put on a direct bus, given that we weren't able to persuade the health service to change where it provided its services. And within 3 years, we came down to below the UK average. And that amounted, in a population of 300,000 people, that meant that within 3 years we were saving 33 babies from dying every year, never mind the amount of perinatal morbidity. And we wouldn't have known that had we not gone out to talk to the local community and to identify what the real problems were. I have other examples which time will not allow, but I think one of the key issues here is that professionals and planners, as professionals, we may have many of the pieces of the jigsaw, but it's the community who can help pull all of those pieces together so we can see the complete picture. I'm going to give you just another quick example of a project I'm still involved with down in Cornwall, in a very deprived part of the UK. A housing estate, very deprived, 1,500 homes, population of 6,000 people. I'm going to go back to the early stages of this project, which was in the 1990s. It had the most horrendous profile. Accidents, crime and domestic violence, pet torture, vandalism, drug and alcohol abuse, low scores, educational scores in our schools, joyriding, unemployment, lots of children on the at-risk register, really dreadful situation. Just going to skip over these, but within 3 years, enabling that community to take control of their own environment with the support of professionals rather than being dictated by the professionals, you can look at the situation here. We went from 18 cases during 1995-96 of postnatal depression to 4 only 3 years later, 19 children on the at-risk register to only 8. The boys' SAT scores, the educational scores, had more than doubled during that period of time. Asthma prevalence was reduced. Fuel bills on the estate have reduced by £180,000 a year because of the investment in the infrastructure, which also provided local employment because we only employed people from that local community. And 87% of residents then felt safe in their community, whereas hardly any of them did at the start of the project. But this isn't easy. This bottom-up approach isn't easy, as we all know. We've heard about the Ottawa Charter, and most people think about strengthening community action, developing personal skills, creating supportive environments. But this little bit here, the enabling, the mediation, and the advocacy, that's the role for public health in supporting local community action. I could give you some other examples, but I don't think time will allow. What I would say is, when we in the voluntary sector, look at government and the bureaucracies, we think how complex it is. We think how difficult it is to gain access into those complex bureaucracies. If you're sitting in government and you're looking at the voluntary sector, They think exactly the same. Look how wide it is. Look at the scope, the huge scope. If you're commissioning services, how difficult it is to actually navigate your way through the complexity of voluntary organisations. There is a lack of cohesion in the third sector. There's even competition between those bodies. And, of course, they provide a whole variety of services, either as condition-specific charities, patient support groups, advocacy bodies, etc. So we need a plan. This is rather interesting because someone did a close-up of this and it was actually upside down. We need to have a plan. Let me go back. We need to have a plan if we're ever going to help people who could actually support the third sector understand how to work with it and navigate their way through. This again was George Bush who said, "I am mindful of the difference between the legislative branch of government and the executive branch. They pass the laws and then I execute them." The point of this slide is that in enabling local community action, we mustn't let government off the hook. There are things that only government can do. And if I just take you through some of these things, what's in the toolbox for national government? What are the things that national government can do that will be a complement to local community action? And they can use all of these tools, from legislation to regulation, organisational change, public education, how they use the budget, what sort of professional development and regulatory mechanisms they put in place, how they use all of the fiscal policy tools that are at their disposal. We must not let government off the hook as well, because these things have a disproportionate benefit upon the worst off in our communities. The other thing that national government will often do is when they're faced with a rather tricky or controversial issue, they will often turn to the third sector. I don't know about here in the United States, but back in the United Kingdom, when HIV arose during the 1980s, became a major issue, there was major concern in government about how acceptable it would be for government to directly intervene. So they gave money to the third sector, and it was the third sector that initially, this whole issue of outhousing, provided services and support and brought the issue very much to the attention of the public. And it was only when there was a certain level of public acceptability that government was then prepared to also provide direct services. So the third sector has a key role there. The other thing that I discovered when I was doing my own research many years ago, looking across the globe at the factors that either lead to success or indeed act as constraints in translating policy into practice, is that countries around the world use what I call third-party advocacy. People sitting in administrations, often professionals working for government, who felt they could not be advocates within government because it would be in conflict with their role, would provide information and sometimes resources to third-party organisations who would then act as the advocates for government to change its approach. So this issue of third-party advocacy is another role for the third sector. What does the third sector need in order to be more effective and efficient? Well, it does need resources, quite often seed money to get up and running. It needs facilitating and nurturing by government. We need to identify local champions, both in the lay communities and also champions in the professional groups. We need training and development, both for the professionals and people in the communities. There needs to be a genuine transfer of power and authority, which is often really very tricky for those of us who have grown up being used to having a certain degree of authority that goes with our professional roles. That often requires intermediaries and brokers to work between the professionals and the people in the community. People are skilled at doing this. And it requires quality information upon which to base decisions and help with monitoring and support and evaluation. Well, as we travel down this road, we don't have all of the answers, but there is that lovely phrase that says, "Go as far as you can see, because when you get there, you can see further." And I think we have more than enough knowledge about how to work with communities to do more than we're doing at the moment, and we'll learn more as we journey down that road. And it was George Bush who said, "If we don't succeed with this, then we run the risk of failure." And he's absolutely right. So can we build a better future for everyone in society, particularly for those who are marginalised and the most disadvantaged? Can we do that? Well, I think as we stand here today, we don't have just a future, a destiny that we're going to travel to. We actually have a variety of possible futures. And the type of future that we actually end up with is down to the choices that we and our politicians and our communities make. We don't have a fixed future at the moment. It's almost like a set of parallel universes. We have a range of futures depending upon the choices that we make today. So I'm going to finish with this poem from Ella Wheeler Wilcox, and I think it sums up that last point. One ship sails east and another sails west with the selfsame wind that blows. It's the set of the sails and not the gales that determines the way we go. Like the winds of the sea are the winds of fate as we journey along through life. 'Tis the set of the soul that determines the goal and not the calm or the strife. Thank you for listening.